السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله
الطاهرين. So tonight is the last lecture. I want to thank everyone for being very welcoming towards me during these 3 or 4 nights. I want to thank the board for the accommodation that they provided, and to those who provided the food during the last 3 or 4 nights, I want to also thank them. The food was very good. In relation to nurturing the child in the 0 to 7 year class or period, some people ask me just before coming and starting, they said, can you just clarify what you mean when you say let the children be free and do whatever they want? Because sometimes in the center they may play around with the microphone or the camera or do other things which can be troublesome. Now before I answer that, I want you to appreciate that the answers I give, these are ideal answers. It doesn't mean everyone has to commit to it 100%, because it's very difficult to commit to them 100%. And they're not wajib. These are ethical guidelines. So everyone to their own capacity. I want to first clarify that. So when the Islamic texts call the child in this period a master, this is what it means. They can do whatever they want. Either, now if the child in the center is bothering people, the first point is no one should tell them off. Right? That would classify or qualify as disciplining them. And that's we shouldn't do. Either the parents shouldn't bring them in if the child is very troublesome, and that is a last resort because that may have problems of its own. Or the center has to organize a place, a room in the center or even outside the center where they can allow the children to express themselves as they want. Or you have to put the microphone or the camera or other things not within their reach. But disciplining the 0 to 7 year old, that's not desirable in Islam. We don't have that. And in the very few instances where you can discipline them, which I haven't mentioned, and I would rather not go into detail right now, yes, there are exceptions, but this is the norm. The fact is that they are described as Sayyid, and that's not a very easy adjective just to pass by. It's something very noble. And as I said last night, the aim is for them to acquire that i'timad and trust, especially towards their parents, so that in the second 7 years that subservience will be facilitated. They also said, what did you mean by not disciplining them in their eating and in their sleeping patterns? I meant, you can't say to them, or you shouldn't say to them, you have to have food at 6 o'clock or else. Lunch is at 1 or no lunch. Sleeping is at 7 o'clock or we punish you. No. The children, when they're tired, they sleep. When they're hungry, they'll eat. You can't discipline them in this area. You can put it in front of them, they'll eat it or they won't. Yes, I mean, if you accustom them to bad habits, such as watching television until late night, that's your fault. But assuming they're not accustomed to any bad trades, you shouldn't discipline them even in these fields. Now, yes, this is going to be very difficult for the parents, especially the mother. Here, if the man can, if they get an assistant, a nanny, an au pair. You don't have to get one from outside. Teenage sisters, for example, in our own community, you can pay them something also. If they come 2 or 3 hours during the day and their mother can rest, that rest of 2 or 3 hours, for example, during the day, will make her stronger during the night with the child. And there may be other ways you can deal with it. You have to use your own initiative. I'm only giving you the general, the universal principles. Now, you can think of maybe better methods. But we'll go through Q&As later, inshallah. I just want to finish 2 points in this important stage. So we want to... In relation to... We want the child to be well balanced in their growth, especially in the first 7 years. We want a well-balanced, multi-dimensional child. If they want to manifest in one particular dimension to the detriment of other dimensions, that's not the ideal that Islam is looking for. Don't think by not allowing your children to socialize or be emotional, and you just teaching them religion, sometimes sticking it down their throat morning and night, don't think you're doing a service to the child or to Islam. Such children will be abnormal in their later years. So even with religion, you shouldn't overdo it. Now I just want to give you a model of how the Imams, what they intended in relation to the religious dimension of children. Now, there are so many traditions, some of them are very particular, that every year what you have to do until 40 years of age, some of them until 70. They're very good traditions, but they need explaining, so I didn't really want to enter those. But look at this tradition, which there are plenty with the same tone as this tradition. That at 3 years of age, you teach them Tawheed. We said teaching is okay, disciplining is not okay. Discipline says you have to do this, do that, homework, deadlines. You can teach them. They may not learn, they may not want to, okay. Teaching a better way, more exciting way. But here, Islam has advised that at 3 years of age, you teach them Tawheed. What does that mean? Just teach them La ilaha illallah 7 times. Tell them to repeat it. That's it. And then leave them. It's incredible. Look how we feed them religion. And look how the Imams want it. Now, I'll tell you what they mean by, or maybe what they mean by leave them. But let's go first through the tradition. At three, so when 3 lunar years is completed, you start with Tawheed. Now, you may say, so what are you going to do for the first 3 years? Well, focus on other dimensions. Their vocabulary, their emotional side, their social side, psychological side. Not from, you know, from a very young age, you keep on putting on tapes, programs, books, all on religion, keep on feeding them. No, it's not normal. This is not normal behavior. Yet we want well-balanced, multi-dimensional children. Teach them some vocab, speak with them. Just speak like normal things. On the margin, I have to be frank with you, Muslim children, their vocabulary is not strong. It's not, you know, when you compare it to the national norm. In England, this is the case, but I'm not sure about America. You have to be careful. You've brought them here, they're going to be brought on, they have to be able to speak properly, with good vocabulary, to be aware of the literature of the country. You can't just isolate them, it won't be normal. Then you leave them. Then the Imam says, at 3 years and 7 months and 20 days. Now this is incredible. Because when the Imam is being so specific, there may be an equation here. That doesn't mean if you don't stick to it exactly, it's all over. No. But try and stick to this. Maybe it has a specificity in relation to human growth that we're not aware of. But the 3 years, 7 months and 20 days, teach them to say seven times, Muhammadun Rasulullah.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
When? Almost 7 months after Tawheed. Sometimes the child may hear before 3 years and 7 months, may hear a group saying something and may come and ask you, that's different. But you going to the child and teaching, this is the protocol. These are two different things. Then leave them. In between, I'll explain what to do in between. At 4 years, teach them to say, seven times, Sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. At 4 years, the 4 years is completed. Wa alayhi being important. Now you're introducing the Ahlul Bayt. Naturally, you have to give the meanings when you tell them to say it to the best of their potential and understanding. Then leave them. At 5 years of age, teach them the left and right hand, which is which. At 5 years, assuming they don't know, which is the left hand, which is the right hand. Introduce them to the Qibla. Let them face the Qibla and tell them to go into the Sajda, prostration position. It's the first thing of Salat, which you want to introduce. And it's the most humble aspect, component of Salat. It's the Sajda. And tell them to go in the Sajda position. They know Tawheed, and say, go into the Sajda. When? At 5 years. Now before that they may see you do the Salat and they keep on doing those, that's okay. But you teaching them at 5 years. At 6 years, teach them the washing of the face and the arms. That is in the wudu. But just the washing. How they wash the face and how they wash the arms. Not the wudu. You don't teach them the wudu yet. You just teach them the washing components of the wudu. And also, in relation to Salat, at the same time, 6 years, teach them the different components of the Salat. Not that they should do it, but the different components, the Qiyam, Ruku, and other components. Then, in the 7 to 8 year period, I know we're drifting out of the 0 to 7, but for completion's sake, if I can just finish this. It's better. Otherwise, it's good to do it at 9. But it's better at 7 and 8 years of age. That's the time you teach them the whole wudu and the whole salat. You teach them. And if you don't, at 9 years of age, you do teach them. In some traditions, it says whenever they perceive. They have that faculty of perceiving properly. When you explain things to them, they say, start then. this tradition will help those who mature a bit earlier. But still, be careful you don't push them. From puberty onwards, you have to be more strict, and since puberty is in the 7 to 14 year period, their discipline, it doesn't matter. But before that, this was the protocol. Now you may say, the sisters at 9 years, when they reach canonical puberty, not medical puberty, but the Sharia has a different definition of puberty for sisters. It's when 9 lunar years is completed. You may say it's difficult for them to fast, for example. Of course it may be difficult. There's no problem if there's so much burden that they can't tolerate it physically, then they don't do it. You don't have to push them. And then they can compensate for that. Islam doesn't want any burden, excessive burden on anyone. So don't, you know, fear that. And if the sister says she can't, you listen and don't force it upon her. Okay, so what do we understand from this general protocol? First, we see it's a very slow, gradual, step-by-step method of teaching religion. And here, aqa'id, tawheed, and nubuwwat are of primary importance. And in relation to the ahkam, it's salat is of primary importance. That's it. Other things outside this, in the early years, it's not necessary. It's not necessary. Exceptions exist, but you don't have to go overboard with this. You may overdo things. Don't burn them. And it's a very easy and simple protocol. Now, in between these dates, these timings, when the Imam says leave them alone, you can, through different media, such as games or other things, try and reinforce those elements, which is on a par with the different ages that we specified. Try to reinforce it through either stories, cartoons, films, but do it in a very exciting way. Now that changes from one era to this era. For example, 10 years ago they were teaching another way, 40 years ago it was another way, today it's another way. Make sure also you teach them in a way that you're not miserable when you're teaching them. You're not gloomy when you're teaching them. No one's forcing you to teach them. So if you want to do it, make sure you're giving you all your time and effort. And since it's the parents in this 0 to 7 phase which do most of the teaching, allocate the time carefully and give them your time in that regard. Other things to do in between those things, well, focus on other elements. Cultural elements, language elements, traveling elements, social elements. There are so many other things to do with the well-being of the child. Well, do those. Religion-wise, this is what you need. Now, there are some actions which there have been in the traditions, you do see a particular desire from the imams that these are passed on to the children. Not through discipline, but in a way which you don't discipline them, but you can convey it to them, and it's a very great effect. One of those is the Holy Quran. For them to read it, to memorize it. But when you see they can't do it, or it's becoming a burden, you should never, you know, go that one step extra. And you shouldn't be disappointed, there's so much time for them learning the Quran in the future. But it's a well-balanced child who can accept the truth easier than a child which isn't well-balanced. Some people may not have religious parents, but the parents provided them a psychologically, socially, culturally well-balanced environment. And when they grew up, they accepted Islam at a much faster rate and a much deeper and a more effective way than many children of religious parents who weren't balanced. So don't think you have nothing else to do. No, you have many things to do for the well-balanced being of the child. So the Quran is one which is prescribed in the traditions. Some ahadith, especially the ethical ones, very important ones, like not lying, not harming people. These things, if you can instill in your children at an early age, for it to be imprinted within their hearts at an early age, it's prescribed by the Imams. Writing is also very desirable. Teaching them how to write. No discipline, but to the best of their capacity, it's something important. In relation to sports, in the 0 to 7 period, it's not something which there are too many options available, but it's good. But especially for the 7 to 14, there are many sports that are prescribed. Poetry has been also prescribed, especially those which laud and commend the praises of religion and the Ahlul Bayt. But teaching them poetry, and this was a custom which in Iran, when you look at the biographies of the Marajim, great scholars, they all say that within the early years of their life, from 4 to 6, the likes of Imam Khomeini and others, they were taught poetry of Sa'di, and they would say that those poems had an effect on our lives. Now, as I say, the way you do it, you have to be very careful. But poetry is something commended by the Imams. Also hygiene. There are many things in hygiene you can start teaching them in the first 7 years. For example, going to the lavatory the last thing at night, the first thing in the morning, brushing one's teeth. Certain eating habits they can learn from you. They learn from what they see. If you eat in a bad way, if you eat fast, if you eat in large morsels, if you eat, they learn those patterns. So here in these hygiene and eating and other patterns, they're learning from you. Okay. So that was one thing I wanted to mention. And the last point I want to mention before we come to questions is the thing that many people ask. And it's an issue because of the culture gap between the parents and the child. Sometimes it's a generational gap between the parents and the child. Sometimes it's because this area is a taboo area for the parents, not necessarily for the child who was brought up here. And these gaps and clashes don't help. And that's the question of sex education at schools, for example, in public schools, primary schools, secondary schools, whatever it is. How should we go about this? When is the age? If they're teaching our children, let's say at 9 or 10, what should we do? Shall we tell them to not attend? What if the teacher doesn't allow that? And similar questions like this. Now, I once gave a parents' workshop in Virginia, Manassas Mosque. And I think that's available online. If you put parents' workshop and then my surname, you should be able to find it. And I went into this into more detail, but just in case you don't find it, just one or two points I want to mention in this regard. In Islam, what we see is, when it comes to sex education and the sexual identity of the child, because that has to be nurtured too, and The sexual identity can't be nurtured if the biological, cultural, psychological, and social dimensions aren't paid heed to properly. One's sexual identity is a result and product and offshoot of how those other dimensions are nurtured. All these have to be in harmony with one another. That's one point. Here we see that in Islamic teachings, in the first 7 years, Islam has given an indirect method of sex education. And then in the second 7 years, it's a more direct approach Islam has given. It's very delicate, actually. Let me just go through some examples. Here, the question is, when I say sexual identity or sex, by sex I mean one's awareness of one's male or female nature. Nothing to do with the act or anything. Because sometimes some people come to me and say, why do you speak about that? And they didn't understand the whole point. I mean, by sex I mean male or female. And that awareness of one's male or female nature, this has an identity attached to it. Islam appreciates this and has given protocols for the child to acquire this identity in a calm and constructive way. Because if one's identity in this domain is compromised, it's going to cause problems in future years. Islam has given a number of steps here. I'll just go through them. What I'm suggesting is that the rationale behind these steps is because Islam wants to, for one, to cultivate a normal identity in one sex. We have many traditions that parents have to hold each sex, be it boy or girl, in great esteem, with honor, with respect. Be it a boy or a girl, there should be no preference, no favoritism, no comparing one better than the other. The worst thing a parent can do, and it's come in traditions, that you shouldn't raise the child in a way that they say, I wish I wasn't a girl, or I wish I wasn't a boy. That's detrimental in relation to identity. You have to express words and actions of honor and gratitude in front of the child. There's one point which there's some disagreement amongst some psychologists, Islamic psychologists. Some say that when you express words of gratitude and goodness to them, some say that you are very good. Some say that this action of yours is very good. Some people say, don't say that you are very good, say your actions are very good. Because they fear that it may enhance the egoism of the child. There may be some discussion there. I just want to appreciate there is some differences there. Traditions, we see there are values that the imams wanted the father to pass these values to the male child, not the mother. Or there are values for the young female infant or child that the mother has to pass on, not the father. And the reason for this is that it may lead to a confusion in the child's identity. For example, in this early first 7 years, adorning the female is very desirable. Adorn her. Buy her things to adorn herself with, especially in the house or in other gatherings. But let her understand this, and here the mother plays more of a role. Don't think it's bad if they, for example, with their nails, they color it or wear certain things or earrings. All this is good for the first 7 years, especially in relation to that sexual identity. They have to understand this. For males, no such advice or prescription is given. And there's no need, and it shouldn't be done. That confusion may arise. When it comes to bathing children, Islam suddenly comes and says, for the three-year-old onwards, if it's a girl, the mother has to bathe. If it's a boy, the father has to bathe. Even if Islam doesn't say it's wajib. But here, when it gives you this advice, because it's referring to this reality, the ethicists have said this, that it leads to, because the sexual identity of the child, from two or three, it's starting. That awareness is starting. That differentiation that a boy is different to a girl, that I am similar to my father rather than my mother, it's starting. It's not complete by any means, but at two or three, very rudimentary, on a very rudimentary level, things start. So for bathing, the similar sex has to bathe. It may lead to a confusion in their identity. Seven or eight, still the mother is bathing the male child. It may lead to problems. Also the other way around. And they came to the Imam and one of them asked, until when should the mother wash the female? He said, up to 3 years. And the scholars say it may give wrong signals in relation to the sexual identity. From 3 to 5 years, here, that identity is still growing. And here, the child is interiorizing and accommodating that which he sees in the parents into oneself. And that's why it's better for the male child to be with the male parent primarily. If the father wants to work morning to night, without a doubt, you're compromising on the identity of the child. I understand that work is important. I understand in America it's difficult and you have to work. But sometimes in life you have to make and prioritize things. The prioritizing is up to you. But a male child from 3 to 5, let's say, or especially 0 to 7, but from 3 to 5, when they're copying everything, they're emulating everything. Islam says that the father need to be with the father primarily, so that they see in certain scenarios how the father acts. They see the father, they see when they go out, he goes out with the father, even when they're buying gifts, the father has to buy certain gifts for the male child. Here, it's very sensitive times. Now, a parent, first of all, with divorced couples, there's going to be some compromise there in one's identity, especially if the child is in the first 7 years. In the second 7 years, it's less. In the third 7 years, the complications will be less for the child if a divorce results. But in the first 7 years, if divorce really is a last resort, do your best. It doesn't happen in the first 7 years. But in divorce, last results may even dictate that. And with a female child, the mother plays a primary role. That doesn't mean the father doesn't play a role. Same with the male child. They both play roles, but there's a primary emphasis with the parent of the same sex. The primary emphasis is there. Okay. So here we see this. Then the question of, in the traditions, we see that from 6 years onwards, you shouldn't let, it's not wajib, but it's not ethical, because there's no Sharia duty here yet, but don't let from 6 years for daughters be kissed by non-mahram men. It's not light at all. And there may be a case for prohibition if secondary results arise. I don't go too much into detail. But the rationale is important. Because if they become accustomed to this, later on, in the later years, it will facilitate their being influenced by non-mahram men much easier. Much easier. Whereas when, after a certain age, there is no access, even though it's not asked by fiqh, it's much more difficult for them to give in later years. The same with boys apply to. This is at the 6 or 7 year age. The separating from the bedrooms, if it's a boy and a girl, or with one's parents, is also suggested from 6 or 7 years of age. Some traditions say 10 years of age. If you look at it from 7 to 10, and look how developed your child is, and then you can base your decision then. But see, all these gradual steps is in the creating of a particular identity here. All this was indirect. All these were protocols to be practiced. No one is speaking about educating yet. They're all indirect steps. From 7 to 14, now here there's no particular age. For some, if they're very, they acquire that developmental, you know, mental stage at a much earlier age, maybe at 7 or 8, for some later. But sexual education has to happen in this second 7 years, and it has to be incremental. You don't tell them everything from the very beginning. You explain it in a very simple language, but you don't lie in the second 7 years. Don't lie to them. Don't say, we've bought, for example, say, where did this child come from? Well, God gave it to us all. You know, silly things like that. You have to be as precise as possible, but it has to be in steps. You don't have to give them the whole truth in the beginning. But very slowly, when the questions become more and more precise, you answer more and more precisely. And then maybe for some, at 8 or 9 or 10, you can be frank with them. But the aim is, they should be taught this kind of education from the parents before they go to school. You have to tell them. If you don't tell them and allow for the school to tell them, you may be compromising because you don't know how they're being taught. But if they're well prepared, they're at school, they won't be affected by how they're taught, and they'll come to you and then even discuss it with you, and therefore that would be maybe more preferable. So that education, don't worry when it is, but it's in the second 7 years, and it's a gradual thing. That's all I can really suggest. I can't give an age, I can't go into any particularities, it depends on the child and other things. And also get help from your seniors, the senior members of the community, teachers of the community. Sometimes they can give you steps that maybe I can't. Well, everyone has to use their initiative, but these were some general steps which I wanted to mention. Okay. So now, I think I've covered most of what I wanted to cover in the first 7 years. The second and third 7 years, inshallah, another time. It was 3 years since we last met, inshallah. I'll meet you earlier than that. Yeah. Now we go to question and answers, and be free to ask your questions. Here, someone gave me a list of questions that different members of this community have asked, but they prefer to write it down rather than asking it in front of everyone. I can go through these, but you can also ask questions. So I'll go through one or two, and then I'll put it to you to ask questions. You can either ask your questions orally, or you can write it down, whichever you prefer. Now, some of these we've covered. Yes. So explaining the seven years of the first, second, third, we've gone to some, well, we went to with the first 7 in detail, but I did explain the rationale behind the second and third. is what mode of Islamic education is appropriate at each age group? We've only gone through the first 7 years. With the second 7 years, yes, you have to discipline them, and now you have to go through the different sciences that exist with the child. Just even the school system here, it's okay, but now they have to start learning that. In relation to Islamically too, they have to start learning. Now, how much they have to learn? You can, for example, look at various Islamic countries, how they have ascertained the content, quality, and quantity for a 7 to 14 year old, for example, in countries like Iran. And then you can use that as a good standard. If it's too much, you can then bring it down. If it's too little, you can give it more. But you have to start educating with discipline in the second 7 years. What's the best method and current age to inculcate basic wajibat? I think we've gone through that to some extent. How much should parents be relying on the Sunday school to provide religious guidance versus providing it at home? They shouldn't rely at all on Sunday school, because I don't think Sunday school should be relied upon, because it's a minimum. Sunday school is good for children getting together and praying, but knowledge-wise, they shouldn't rely too much, especially for the children. At home for the first 7 years is priority. For the second 7 years, if Sunday school is the last resort, well, you have nothing better, yes. But still don't rely, unless the Sunday school teacher is a scholar. A scholar is pivotal for a community. A community without a scholar, sooner or later, will fall spiritually. Now, yes, this community has its own stories with scholars, and this community actually has a very good infrastructure, I have to say. And maybe the scholars you've had in the past have contributed to that. But alhamdulillah, the infrastructure is a good infrastructure here when I compare it with other communities. But in general, you shouldn't rely on the Sunday school. Now, there are other questions, but anyone, do they have any questions? Or?
I'll ask you.
Yes, yes.
What about the people who don't accept their own sexual identity, and later on in life they even go to surgeries to change that?
Yes.
And also I believe that Islam to some extent it allows it.
Yes.
That's the first question.
Yes.
And the second question is about the homosexuals. When you ask them, when you tell them this behavior is wrong, and they say they were born that way.
Yes.
So how do you explain that?
Yes, these are two questions which aren't directly related to child nurturing, but the answer to these questions are very lengthy. With the homosexuality issue, I do have a lecture, and it's online. It's 1 hour long with 20 minutes of Q&A. I gave it at the University of Michigan. But when you said they were born homosexual, it's possible to be born homosexual as a result of certain actions that your parents or grandparents did. It is possible for a child to be born that way. That doesn't mean we're condoning it, but it is something possible. It's not impossible, it's in the genes. But that doesn't mean we have to condone it or favor it. We have to work with that child. They need counseling in a certain way, the earlier the better. Changing the sex too. That's allowed, it was allowed by Imam Khomeini, and it's allowed by most maraji, but they have one or two stipulations. Going through the fiqh of that is a bit complicated right now. But it's an important question as what defines the sex of a child. Is it the anatomy? Is it the genes? Or is it the gender, the psychology? Here, if someone has the anatomy of a male, and the genes are XY, the genes of a male, but their gender, their psychology is female predominantly, they need counseling. We have to work with them. We can't just say they are female. It's not as easy as that. There's a unity between gender and sex. And therefore, when we see the harmony being broken, we have to mend that. And there are reasons why there's a female predominance over a male offspring who is XY and with the male anatomy, but the psychology is becoming strongly female, if you go and study their early years, you see usually they didn't have a father figure, for example, or there were other things that exist. These people need counseling, but the earlier the better. They may, according to some marriage, then do the operation. It is allowed. Not with Ayatollah Khomeini and Ayatollah Sistani, if it's only a question of female psychology. With them, they have more other stipulations for it to be allowed. But with Imam and maybe others, it is allowed in any case. But these discussions, these are very lengthy discussions. I would have to go through them in more detail. But it can be found online if you're interested. Okay, back to the list. What is the Islamic perspective on the cry-it-out method for putting kids to sleep, also known as the fervor method? Well, based on the universal principles I've given, it's not something which is desirable, especially when you see the child is hurt or burdened with this just crying more and more. Sometimes it's only for a few minutes and it dies out, yes, but sometimes for a long time. That's not desirable. I think the mother's comfort would be better here. To what extent should parents insist on the mustahabat and the makruhat versus focusing only on the wajibat within their children? Never focus on the mustahabat and the makruhat, especially in the first and second 2-7 years, when you see the wajibat is still not complete. You're doing them a disservice. Let them learn those themselves at their own pace. Any questions? Yes, sorry.
So if there's a mother set that caters to kids under 7,
yeah.
Where does the whole let the kid be the master play into that from the teacher's point?
Right, so the teacher should discipline. And they do discipline, that's the problem. Because most of the teachers of the madrasas, they're not qualified teachers. Teaching is one of the prophetic traits. It's a very noble profession. You can't just bring someone for their spare time doing volunteering work. I know they're doing it with good intentions. I'm not speaking, I don't know about this community. I'm speaking in general, the communities I've seen. But this is children we're speaking about. You can't, they've woken up, they've had an argument with the spouse, for example. Now they're coming miserable, they come to school. They don't know how to be a teacher, it's volunteering work. And then they're going to be angry, they're going to discipline, say, you shush, you this, you that. And it's a mess, everything's a mess. So there you have to teach the teachers how to teach children. These principles that we've gone through for the first 7 years, they have to be abided by. Yes. It's difficult, yes. No one said it's easy. But the parents shouldn't think it's a free, just a cop-out, just sending their children to whoever they want. The parents have to make the effort primarily. Okay? How far should we go as far as restraining our children from the participating in non-Muslim celebrations, such as Halloween, Christmas, etc.? Is this something that is not worth the battle? How should we inculcate values at an early age to avoid their attraction toward these things? Well, Halloween, Christmas, Easter, today in America, no one is celebrating Halloween based on what the real Halloween was all about. Even for Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving has a history to it. No one is celebrating that history. Most children, they don't know what it's about. Christmas too, unfortunately, has become like that. Easter too. Most children aren't doing it. So if your child goes to Halloween or Thanksgiving, don't think they are disseminating or propagating those messages. If it really is a case, they shouldn't do it. In relation to Christmas, it's not a problem because we also believe in Nabi Isa. Okay, maybe the dates we don't believe and all that. And the question that it was a 25th of December was the date of the idols, the sun idols, but no one knows about the history of exactly what the 25th was. And everyone is saying it was the birth of Christ. You're celebrating it with them, that's okay. So on the whole, if nothing is done against Islamic values, and you are doing something which qualifies as you spreading what Thanksgiving was all about, it was a Puritan movement, for example, and you are disseminating that movement, that's not the case. But if it was, you're confirming that message, that would be problematic. Or if you're disseminating what Halloween was all about originally, or Bonfires Night, for example, those kind of things. And the point is, it's not like that. And therefore, you shouldn't even worry too much about these things. But if these celebrations are associated with actions which goes against Islamic ahkam, that's problematic then. I can't think of any. Maybe for Christmas, drinking, maybe, yes. There you can't. Go to those kind of parties, and so on and so forth. But right now, I can't think of anything severely wrong. Yes, sometimes you see a child may be influenced by these kind of parties to the detriment of Islamic parties. Yes, that you have to monitor. So you let them go to those parties if you want, but you compensate by having Islamic parties, birthday of the Holy Messenger and other events, you also celebrate them properly, have a festival. And that may not be seen too much in various communities. When it comes to the musibat and commemorating the martyrdoms, mashallah, we're very good at that. This is what I speak about not being balanced. We're not very balanced people. When it comes to birthdays of the imams, we let it go very simply. But we should express even more emotion at the birthdays than the events of the martyrdom. But we're not seeing that. Okay, any question before we continue? Yes.
Bearing all educational systems that are in place, what is the most ideal situation where you start or where you stop co-ed education? Starting from maybe, let's say, kindergarten to secondary school, where is the place where you would start co-ed? Would you not have it? What is Islam's position on this?
I think from 0 to 7, it's not a problem. So the nurseries, for example, and any kind of educational system before 7, I don't think it's something which you should, co-education should fear that thing, yes. There may arise things in those systems under 7, and that those you have to treat on a case-to-case basis. But in general terms, you shouldn't fear that for the first 7 years. For the second 7 years, I think even in the West, they are appreciating that on an academic level, it's better if you separate males from females in the educational system. Certainly in England, I've seen the research. Maybe in America you see that, but that's only academically. Socially though, let's say this environment where it's co-educational and it's not compromising the academia, it's not bad for a co-educational system. They can grow. However, whereas in the first 7 years I would say don't fear all in all, for this second 7 years there is more to fear. Because, for example, in America or other countries, in the second 7 years, they are very liberal children. And then if your child is not fully prepared by you, or the trust towards the parents isn't strong, you can't send them unarmed. I'm saying unarmed in the yes, metaphoric sense. But or they have to be strong when they go. If they're strong and they can go, they can benefit a lot socially, psychologically. But if they're not, there's more to fear here. And also, since academically it's proven that it's better to be separated, I think to be on the safe side, if you can, if there is a private school only for males or females, it would be better. Now you may say it's expensive, and that's okay, but what are you spending the money for? It's for your child. There's no easy way out. It's like a jihad having a child. And then spending money for the child is something very beneficial in this regard. Not getting a loan for this, because most of the loans here It's not Islamic. It's all halal. Unless if you find an Islamic clone, there are some places where, which give these Islamic clones. But don't compromise the children by, you know, just getting a loan which isn't proper. Okay, continue with the list. There's a general lack of quality literature when it comes to Islam and the English language. As such, what solutions do you propose for youth who are in their teenage years? And for example, cannot find a good biography series about the lives of the Imams. Well, actually, it is getting stronger now, the literature. You just have to look more and more online, but they're not few anymore. But the quality, yes, good quality ones, they are lacking. And that's a problem. I don't know, maybe members here have a better answer. I don't know what the answer to this is. But speeches in English, quality speeches, they do exist. I don't really want to give names, but there's a very good orator, well, not an orator, even he's a scholar, but he's a good scholar and an orator. And he has a very good library on his site. And the lives of all the Imams are given there. These things exist online. You can go and find them and benefit from them. Now, maybe one or two scholars have certain controversial areas. You can't just knock them out. Or they have one or two political ideas that you don't have. It doesn't mean just put them to the side. They have 80% of good material too. So you can benefit from those speakers. And we have a lot of English speakers now. So if you go online, these speakers have audio and visual libraries. And you can go through them and benefit from them. Especially in relation to the lives of the Imams. I have seen that list. At what age should parents stop enforcing curfews and house rules and let children be responsible for their own actions? From 14 onwards, gradually, this should happen because there's no discipline anymore. But in a gradual way, not from the very beginning, do whatever you want now, you're free. The second seminary, it was discipline. But in the third, no, it wasn't discipline anymore. But for them to come out of it, it's a gradual process. At what age should parents stop? Yes, sorry. At what age should boys and girls become financially independent? Well, after puberty, whenever they show they're responsible, they can do it. Responsibility is the key, and the Quran, the word is rushd. They have reached a level of rectitude which allows them to do it. If that's there, allow them to start. But gradually, they can't open a business at, let's say, 12, but they can do other independent financial things. If they've shown they're responsible. Any questions?
Maybe the sister.
Yes, any questions from the sisters? Yes. I think we'll go through a list.
Oh,
yes, it's okay.
One general question.
Sure.
You mentioned Ma'asum and the definition of Ma'asum.
Yes.
Speeches.
Yes. Yes.
What happens, the importance of mother? So, in special Quranic teaching, we see what happens in the life of a mother after childbirth, the connection or the relationship between the mother and the child. Can you touch on that?
The right of the mother over the child? The first question was in relation to the term ma'asum, that it doesn't mean sinless. Sinlessness is a consequence of someone who is ma'asum. But ma'asum and being sinless, they're not the same. A two-year-old is sinless. Are they ma'asum? Of course not. If we call it ma'asum, it's wrong. We mean it because we think ma'asum means sinless. But ma'asum, إِنَّ الَّذِينَ قَالُوا رَبُّنَا اللَّهُ ثُمَّ اسْتَقَامُوا تَتَنَزَّلُ عَلَيْهِمُ الْمَلَائِكَةُ. One who says, my Rabb is Allah, aqa'id, tawheed, it has degrees. ثُمَّ اسْتَقَامُوا, action, they're steadfast upon their aqa'id, action. Action has degrees. The higher the degrees, تَتَنَزَّلُ عَلَيْهِمُ الْمَلَائِكَةُ, angels descend upon them. Ismat is an index of that angelic contact that one has. The prophets had it from birth. In the stories of the prophets, when the 2 or 3 year olds would do certain things, our holy messenger wouldn't do it because the angels would tell them. The contact with angels was always there. That's what Maksum means. Sometimes that angelic contact is more in time and over time, because Ismat has degrees too. Some are more Maksum than others. Sometimes it's less, that angelic contact. The angel tells the prophets what to do, what not to do, even as a child. That's why the prophets are unschooled. They don't need to go to school. They don't need to read a book, like me and you. They don't need a teacher, because angels are guiding them. It's divine guidance they have. And that, after a certain level, we say it's Maksum, when they are mukhlas. And that has a definition of its own. From mukhlas onwards, the degrees of infallibility can vary. So that was one point. Yes, the second point was, I'm not precisely sure what is meant, but I think I'll give an answer. If it's not sufficient, then you can just correct me. When the mother, the importance in the time of gestation is crucial, because gestation is maybe the most important phase in child nurturing. But the mother doesn't have to, yes, so that's for the 9 months. Now, here the father has to, the husband has to provide everything which the mother requires during that time. After gestation, in the first 7 years, the child, the right of the mother over the child is complete. I mean, the mother has the primary role in nurturing this child. And no other entity can compensate for this. And that's why, if God forbid a divorce happens in the first 7 years, the custody will go to the mother until 7 years. If it's a girl, if it's a boy though, there's some difference amongst the marriage. If it's a girl though, it's, everyone says, the custody goes to the mother for 7 years. If it's a boy, it depends on your marriage. Some say 7, some say 2 years of age. But just because a man gets custody of, let's say, a 3-year-old boy, it doesn't mean the mother has no access. They have to separate it 50-50. Custody doesn't mean 100% only for the man. That's an issue which is always misunderstood. But in relation to the first 7 years, yet the right of the mother over the child, it's an ethical, nurturing right. Because, I mean, there are other rights don't really qualify. There are no legal things which can qualify in this stage. The child just grows, and the mother has the primary role in relation to the nurturing. So when it comes to breastfeeding, although no one can force the mother to breastfeed, and the mother can demand something in return for actually breastfeeding the child from the husband, and other nafara issues which the woman can take legally, other than that, it's more of an ethical nurturing role that the mother plays. Those things come to mind right now. There may be other things, but I can't recall them right now. Okay, let's go through the list. What role can and should parents play in helping find spouses for their children? Well, the parents play a very important role, a primary role. If it's a boy who... Let me just finish the question. At what age should parents become active in this process? One can't generalize, but after the 3 7-year periods finish, that's a good age for marrying. But maybe even during the 3rd 7 years, if the teenager shows that responsibility, it's okay. But definitely after the 3 years, they should be thinking. They shouldn't delay things more than that. The parents do play a role, and the children should listen to their parents because of the experience the parents have. So if it's a boy, Let the mother see the mother of the to-be spouse. She will learn a lot by seeing the mother, by socializing with the mother. And she knows you. She sees the mother, which usually sisters become their mothers, more or less. And this helps the mother to make that match. But parents shouldn't insist for the children to marry a particular girl. The reason I say that is because Islam doesn't say whatever your parents say in marriage, listen to them, although it's very noble if you do. But Islam has its own criteria when it comes to marriage. And then we have to, parents and children, have to abide by that criteria, not by just merely listening to the parent. If the parents are speaking based on the criteria which Islam has given, okay, so much the better. But here we have to go through the criteria that Islam says. But I think, you know, 18 to 21 is a good age to start. For sisters, if they delay it too much, if there's a reason for that delay, okay, I don't mind. No one can force you to marry. But if you delay marrying, and this delay leads to you emotionally, psychologically, and sexually being compromised at university or the workplace, you're doing a disservice to yourself and the husband-to-be. Therefore, if you want to delay it, make sure you're not compromised in these domains. And these domains, it's very easy to be compromised, because you're expressing emotions in these domains to the other sex to varying degrees, when it should be expressed to one's husband and should be left for one's husband. So that's something one has to be careful. It could also compromise one's nurturing capacity. With men too, this also applies, but not as much as with sisters. Any questions before? There's so many questions here. I don't want to just...
I have a question. So you had mentioned as far as the primary role for children's education, Islamic education, should be with the parents. What do you, and I'm saying this, you know, as a madrasa teacher myself, when you see, for example, some parents who they themselves don't know a lot of the basics.
Right.
So in that situation, would you alter your advice?
I mean, that would be a failure on their behalf, but it's very noble and mature of them. Say, now we can't do it, but they failed in doing it. And it's going to have a bad effect on the child. But at least they've understood that we don't know, let's take them to a madrasa. It's better than nothing, of course. Yes. Okay. What happens if parents didn't encourage or enforce wajibat for the first 20 years of the child's life, and now they're older, 18 or early 20s child, is discouraged from religion and has no interest in practicing Islam? What should parents do to help them get back on track without pushing them too hard? I mean, there's no point in pushing them anymore. They're 20 years old. It's game over now. There's no miracles. I can't have a magic wand or say abracadabra. Here, two things you can do. First, the language of compassion now. It has to be all about compassion. You can't now begin to force something upon them or disown them. Compassion is the first language. Maybe with that compassion, the language of the fitra, if a bit of their fitra is intact, your compassion may lead them to you slowly but surely. That's one route. And then when they show they don't want have any interest in Islam, they don't want to practice, try to see what they're interested in. What has replaced Islam? And then there, sometimes you can very indirectly have discussions on those areas. And if those areas are disproved to them, maybe they'll come. But you have to do it in a very delicate way. You know, the best thing for children is putting them intact, always in contact with a scholar. In the first 7 years, it's the scholar of your area. They come and have programs. Even seeing a scholar on a weekly basis, even if they have silly questions, but seeing their scholar has enormous effects. For the second 7 years, once they can now email and do things, now we have many scholars who are, you have access to, at least electronically. But being in contact with the scholar, if that contact is broken, it's an important downfall in your spiritual lives. Imam Sajjad in Dawiya Hamze al-Thumali, in one part of it, he says, وَلَعَلَّكَ فَقَدْتَنِي مِن مَجَالِسِ الْعُلَمَا فَخَذَلْتَنِي. Maybe, speaking to Allah, maybe you saw me absent in the assemblies of the ulama, and therefore you put me down. This put you down is a cause and effect relationship. You did something to be debased, to be put down. What was it? Losing contact, being absent with a scholar. It's something which I don't think anything can replace a good scholar, because they're always in contact with them, even if it's once a week. And therefore, things which happen during one's life, those big decisions, they always have someone. Yes, a school teacher can replace a scholar to some degree. And therefore, when you have no one, that's second best. But the point is, today we have scholars that are accessible electronically. You can benefit from that. What is the best way to help children at a young age, 6 to 10, fall in love with the Ahlul Bayt and to love participating in programs such as Ashura, Qadir, or other Islamic holidays? In relation to participating in programs, you have to have very exciting programs. It shouldn't be very dull and gloomy. You know, you have to call out to all types of people. And therefore, you know, it doesn't matter. We want to celebrate. You have to celebrate on a par with this culture. How do Americans celebrate? You celebrate like that. But where it goes against Islamic injunctions, no. Otherwise, you can't, you know, expect your children to be brought up in America, but then they have to celebrate how they celebrate in the East. That harmony, it's important to bear that in mind. In order to love the Ahlul Bayt, it's not as easy. It's an easy question to ask. It's a bit difficult to answer, yes. Many times we have the situation whereby one parent is very religious, but the other parent is not very religious. Or sometimes that other parent, I'm assuming it's that other parent, which isn't, undermines basic wajibat in front of the children. How should the more practicing parent deal with such a situation? It's a good question, yes. So you have one parent who is practicing, one parent isn't practicing, and may sometimes even undermine. Here, the parent who is practicing should still respect the other parent, which isn't practicing. The love between them still has to be there, the respect, the body language, especially the children of the first 7 years, everything has to be there as normal. But the practicing parent has to show patience. If one parent shows patience and practices practically, according to Islam, that is enough for that child to accept. But they have to see the practicing parent be calm, be patient, and not disrespect the other party. The child will be surprised. They always understand who is disrespecting who. And they always side with the party which is respecting and always see them as the model. So for the practicing, although it's difficult, they should express more patience. This is the final question on the list, and then I'll put it out to you. Although tomorrow, early morning, I have to go to the airport, so have some, yes, compassion. Some scholars, such as Ayatollah Sistani, have impressed upon the importance of transmitting our mother tongues to our future generations. Can you elaborate on this and what kind of benefits this has vis-a-vis a child's spiritual growth? For example, access to Farsi, Arabic resources, etc. Now, I don't know what Ayatollah Sistani intended, but maybe since most parents today who have their children born here or from the East, Iran, Iraq, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Lebanon, whatever, those countries have rich cultures and have alcohol and have Islam. Those cultures have Islam within them, and an Islam-rich culture. This is just the medium for the child, if they have that cultural aspect preserved. It's a medium for them to learn more about Islam. So maybe he meant, rather than letting your children be West-toxified, don't undermine the cultural element of your parents, which starts with the mother tongue, because that can be a good medium for Islamic values of those cultures to be conveyed. Maybe that's one meaning. That's the list in short. So no questions from the sisters? Okay. وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى آله